I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Barack Obama, in his first speech to the UN General Assembly, today stepped away from Bush-era unilateralism and set a new tone of cooperation for the U.S.
The time has come for the world to move in a new direction. We must embrace a new era of engagement based on mutual interest and mutual respect, and our work must begin now.
But Obama also said those who criticized U.S. unilateralism in the past can no longer stand by and wait for America to solve the world's problems on its own.
Consider the course that we're on if we fail to confront the status quo. Extremists sowing terror in pockets of the world, protracted conflicts that grind on and on, genocide, mass atrocities, more nations with nuclear weapons, melting ice caps and ravaged populations, persistent poverty and pandemic disease. I say this not to sow fear, but to state a fact. The magnitude of our challenges has yet to be met by the measure of our actions.
And while Obama said it's easy to blame others for problems, he singled out North Korea and Iran, who he said must be held accountable if they choose to pursue nuclear weapons. Let's bring in Jonathan Weissman. He's White House correspondent for The Washington Post. He's in New York. And Jonathan, first of all, your overall thought on the tone.
Well, first of all, I'm actually at the Wall Street Journal. So
there you go. Okay. But your thoughts on the tone today, because some were saying it was unusually blunt.
It's interesting because the first part of the speech was actually kind of devoid of a lot of specifics. I actually was worried that this was going to be a lot of pabulum, frankly. I mean, he spent a lot of time trying to distance himself, obviously, from the Bush era, talked about his decision to close Guantanamo and end torture. But then he did go into some very blunt things. He used the term occupation to talk about the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. He also talked about the right of a Jewish state to exist in Israel and with security. And he was pretty blunt with those who criticized the United States, saying, you know, if you criticize us for meddling, you can't now just sit and wait for us to meddle on the things you actually do want us to get involved in.
Well, let's take those one at a time. Let's go to the nuclear issue. He is singling out North Korea and Iran. Obama said he respected their rights and was committed to diplomacy, then went on.
But if the governments of Iran and North Korea choose to ignore international standards, if they put the pursuit of nuclear weapons ahead of regional stability and the security and opportunity of their own people, if they are oblivious to the dangers of escalating nuclear arms races in both East Asia and the Middle East, then they must be held accountable.
President Obama saying the door is open to Iran to discuss the issue, but that U.S. patience is not limited. Is there any sense of what Iran's response is going to be? Because President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is speaking later today.
Yes, we're looking forward to that. I am sure that that Ahmadinejad will once again say that he is pursuing a peaceful nuclear program, that he has no intention of giving it up, and it is the right of Iran, and he will claim leadership of the developing world as to say that there's no apartheid in nuclear technology.
Well, Ahmadinejad pointedly didn't applaud when Obama entered. And Obama didn't mention him by name, but said, there are those in this body who were wrong to question Israel's right to exist. Tell us more about what he said further about the Middle East situation.
Well, he truly pledged his resolve to work on Middle East peace. As I said, he used some hot-button terms. He called spoke of the occupation of Palestinian lands. And he also spoke of a Jewish state of Israel, not some secular term, both of which would cheer and anger different constituencies. But he also said that he spoke of we must remember that the greatest price of this conflict is not paid by us; it is paid by the Israeli girl in Sderot, who closes her eyes in fear that a rocket will take her life in the middle of the night. It is paid by the Palestinian boy in Gaza, who has no clean water and no country to call his own. He was very careful to be balanced on this, but in the balance, he was pretty stern. This is reminiscent of the language he used in his speech to Muslims in Cairo.
Well, in fact, let's hear some of the president's own words on Israeli and Palestinian conflict in the Middle East.
We continue to call on Palestinians to end incitement against Israel. And we continue to emphasize that America does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements. The time has come to relaunch negotiations without preconditions.
Well, Jonathan, I just want to get one last thought from you on what President Obama said or didn't say about Afghanistan. The New York Times reporting today about how the Obama administration might be engaged in a examination of strategy, that it might be considering training Afghan troops to fight the Taliban and moving U.S. troops to target al-Qaeda in Pakistan. And one wonders what signal that sends to countries. Italy, for instance, we saw heartbreaking pictures this week of a little boy at his father's casket, you know, killed in the conflict. Countries who are considering whether they stay in Afghanistan. So what was the message there?
It's a very good point. He did not mention Afghanistan at all. In the section of the speech where he was really trying to say that the United States was turning its page on the Bush era, he said that he is ending a war in Iraq. He did not talk about Afghanistan. Remember, Afghanistan is a NATO-led conflict on the west side. It is not a UN mission. And his avoidance of the Afghan issue was very striking, considering that it is probably a reflection of his own uncertainty about where the U.S. policy is going.
Yeah. Jonathan Weissman, White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Get you at the right paper. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, some of those leaders at the U.N. today will be in Pittsburgh tomorrow for the G20 summit as leaders of the world's 20 largest economies gather. Let's turn there. This will be the first time President Obama hosts a major international event. And as host and leader of the world's largest economy, he's expected to take the lead in brokering a compromise on what some say may be the biggest set of international financial reforms since the Second World War. But a fight over bankers' pay is brewing. We want to take a closer look at that with Christine Harper, chief financial correspondent for Bloomberg News. Christine, we know that over the summer, France in particular already moved to curb executive pay. But give us the overarching thought behind this. Is this about punishing bank executives or using executive pay to achieve other reforms?
Hi. Well, that's a great question, and I think they're trying to do both, really. I think on the one hand, all of these countries want to show to their populations that they're cracking down on bankers that, in many people's view, are overpaid and are responsible for the crisis. And so they want to see some pound of flesh taken. But how you actually do that is tricky, because I don't think, for all the talk about capping pay, many of these countries are willing to do it unless everybody does it, and there are clearly a lot of countries that won't do it. So what they seem to be more agreed on is the importance of aligning pay to the risk-taking at the institutions and making sure that by doing that they can curb the risk that these companies take.
Well, in fact, in reading your writing, we understand that the thing of tying bonuses to more long-term investments rather than risky short-term investments might force banks to have more capital on hand rather than spend it, you know, in risky short-term investments and incur a lot of debt. In fact, some are proposing to tie pay directly to the amount of capital a bank has.
Right, that's a big part of the that may emerge as a part of the compromise that comes out from these talks at the G20, is that, you know, the U.S. approach, and also I think the U.K. is advocating this, is to try to limit risk mostly through requiring the big companies to hold a lot of capital, which is a cushion against losses. So if they lose money, the government doesn't have to bail them out. They have their own money to make up for the losses.
Well, let's take a look at what some countries are already doing. Obviously, France taking the lead, at least seeming to. Just tell us, first of all, what's happened so far. They've already got some clawback options.
Well, in France, what they've done is, in the summer, they got some of the biggest banks to agree to defer a bigger portion of the pay that they give to their employees. And make a lot more of it in stock.
In other words, withhold the pay for, you know, several years, up to 5 years, to make sure that the performance is good.
Exactly right. So you don't, you know, if you put on a risky trade this year and it makes money for the bank, you don't get all your money today, and then find out that trade falls apart in 2 years. So they, you know, by trying to make sure a lot of this is in stock and over time, they've tried to do that. That's not actually very different from what the U.S. and the U.K. are proposing, however. And it's actually not that different from what a lot of the banks do already.
But would you understand in France that's true, that leading banks did agree that bankers would repay parts of bonuses if bank performance was low, and they also agreed to defer at least two-thirds of bonus payments?
And the deferrals we've seen banks worldwide doing this. I mean, it's a shareholder friendly approach. You don't want all your employees leaving right away if they get a big cash payout. So people try to pay them in stock and make them get their stock over time as a way to keep employees. But this is also obviously an effective way to try to tie the employees into the risk of the company.
But I just want to ask a quick question, because France supports some of its industry. So are these restrictions that were agreed to and that banks seem to be following in France, the leading bank, we understand, cut its bonuses in half in 1 month. But is this voluntary?
Well, I think it's a combination of voluntary and government pressure. Obviously, all of the governments are France included, have a lot more leverage over the companies they've directly supported.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that, you know, in the U.S., a good example is the pay czar that was appointed to actually become much more involved in making specific pay rules for the companies that still have a lot of government money in them, where a looser set of rules or guidelines really will apply to the companies that are essentially free of government support at this time.
Well, and the French proposal that this, you know, be more universal won some support at the EU meeting this month. But what's the concern? Who's pulling back and why?
Well, I think, I mean, what I would say is you see running up into the EU meeting, and again, I think this is happening at the G20, when we certainly saw it at the G20 finance ministers meeting a few weeks ago, there's a lot of tough talk going into these events, you know, a lot of talk about taking on the bonus culture, and the Swedish prime minister likes to talk about the bonus bubble bursting, and they talk about capping it, and they talk about cutting bonuses going into it. And when they come out, they all sort of kind of coalesce around this idea that really what they want is not caps, is not cuts, but again, aligning it, requiring more of it to be deferred over time, allowing companies to claw it back if the money ends up being lost in a couple of years. And also another important thing is eliminating guarantees, where you give an employee a guarantee they'll get X amount of dollars no matter what happens, which is a very common practice in the financial industry. And so those are seem to be the areas everybody's agreed upon.
That's Christine Harper, chief financial correspondent for Bloomberg News. She also writes that a Gallup poll shows that 59% of Americans want a curb on executive pay. But how would that work here? And Christine also tells us that one of the concerns is if every country doesn't do it, then the best workers will go to the one that doesn't. We're going to be back with more from Christine in about 1 minute. Later today, a fashion photographer rigs up cameras for people with severe cerebral palsy. We'll hear about the beautiful results. That's later today. Back after a break, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the G20 meeting. It gets underway this week, tomorrow, in Pittsburgh. Our guest is Christine Harper, chief financial correspondent for Bloomberg News. And Christine, we've been talking about the one thing we know will be on the table, which is an attempt to curb executive pay and maybe even tie it to banks having more capital. And you were just talking about the will to do that there's a lot of talk and then maybe not as much follow-through. And I'm just wondering how that may be also different in different countries. We know in France, France's hand seemed to be pushed over the summer by workers who were burning tires and protesting, even kidnapped an executive at one point because of their anger over executive pay. Here in the U.S., you tell us about a Gallup poll, 59% of Americans want a curb on executive pay, but the anger here seems less directly at, you know, big bonuses and bankers. I mean, not to diminish the anger at, for instance, Acorn workers, but it seems to be more directed there. So is there even less will here because people don't seem to be pushing for it as much here in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in the U.S. there's a strong culture that people don't want to see the government involved in in dictating pay. Nobody would like to see Uncle Sam telling them how much they can get paid. They think that's sort of un-American. And so, you know, you even saw overnight Sarah Palin, who's in many ways quite a populist politician, saying, you know, we don't want to see government dictating compensation. So there's not really a strong, even though people are uncomfortable with the size of the bonuses people are getting on Wall Street, especially with unemployment at the levels we see today, they don't quite feel comfortable at the same time with saying the government has to say how much each individual trader and banker can get. So the compromise is something that says, you know, as long as you're making money, as long as the firm as a whole is making money, you can pay what you want, and as long as you're not paying in a way that is going to encourage them to become too risky and threaten the need for taxpayer bailouts.
So just in the few seconds we have, no chance that, as analyst Peter Morici suggests, bonuses should be tied across the board to a fixed percentage of real income the way other, you know, many businesses do it.
I wouldn't rule that out as a possibility, but I don't see that as very likely. And what I'd say is that a lot of companies already do have some sort of ceiling. You know, if you look at the big banks, they try to keep compensation under 50% of revenue. So there tends to be an unofficial cap on that already. And I don't really expect, and I haven't talked to anybody who expects there to be that kind of proposal coming out of the G20.
Christine Harper, again, chief financial correspondent for Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
So how is Pittsburgh preparing for tomorrow? Well, the Coast Guard is closing Pittsburgh's three rivers starting tomorrow morning until Friday night. Thousands of workers are going to telecommute. And Pittsburgh's arts and activist communities are mobilizing as well. One visual artist will be translating tweets from the public into a Morse code light show that's going to be flashed at world leaders from an office building. Others are writing haiku. Here's one. Known for friendliness, we won't be greeting you, thanks to congestion. That's from Mary Shirey, a retired high school teacher. It's one of over 100 entries in Pittsburgh's G20 Haiku Poetry Contest. The winning haiku was penned by Angel Ellis, a professional writer, editor, and community activist who's also keeping an eye on protests that are expected. Angel, would you do us the favor of reading your award-winning haiku?
We harvest leaflets blown like autumn leaves, our hopes speak truth to power.
What a wonderful image of protesters. And we understand that the prize is that your haiku is going to appear on a marquee right near the summit where world leaders can potentially see it. What do you want them to take from it?
What I wanted to do with this haiku was to strike a message both of protest but of hope as well.
Well, something like 10,000 protesters are expected to take part in G20 demonstrations this week, many of them coming from out of town.
Yes, many.
And we know that protest groups have been meeting with city officials for weeks to map out things. Some are going to be allowed to protest, others aren't for logistical reasons. We know you have particular interests in sort of peace protests. What do you want to be communicated in Pittsburgh?
That Pittsburgh is, in many ways, a cradle of activism. I mean, it's known as a steel town, but it is also the site of the famous Homestead Steel Strike in the 1890s. Many radicals and free thinkers have come from this this industrial city, now a post-industrial city. And it's an interesting, wonderful, sort of resilient mix of people. I mean, this is a city that goes on despite everything.
Well, we understand police were even talking at one point about banning the carrying of rotten fruit.
Yes. but not guns, rotten fruit. I don't believe that fruit has been banned, given the publicity that issue brought.
Well, but back to the haikus. Some of them are serious like yours. Some are just fun. All of them have to have the 17-syllable framework. Here's one. No movies tonight. The drama is in the streets. See yins on Monday. Yins.
Yes, yins, the colloquial expression for you, plural.
We have a word like that in New England or New York. It's like, you know, yiz or yous.
Yeah, yous, I've heard.
So we're now going to learn about Pittsburgh's yins. Angel, what is the attitude? I heard a local comedian say, there's a lot of civic pride, you know, people saying, we won the Stanley Cup, we won the World Series, and now we've won the G20, even if we're not quite sure what that is. What is the feeling?
I think that there are mixed feelings, Robin. I have heard reports from some friends who work at the university that some of their colleagues are afraid that the protesters are going to assault them, even if they're not part of the official G20 contingent.
Well, in fact, in London, there were skirmishes with police, and one man died.
Yes, and I don't think we want a repeat of London.
Angele Ellis, she won the Pittsburgh G20 Haiku Contest and is a writer, editor, and community activist there in Pittsburgh. Angele, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, what would happen if states expand Medicaid? We'll take a closer look. Who pays? That's tomorrow. Back after the latest news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
But it is as a motion picture that the Wizard of Oz reaches the full brilliance of its glory. Its colorful beauty and the sheer warmth of its simple story are matched only by the fineness of its unforgettable music.
That's the 1939 MGM radio promo for the then new film, The Wizard of Oz. It moved to television in the 50s, but now its color will be even more brilliant when it returns to the big screen tonight, as 440 theaters mark the movie's 70th anniversary with a screening of a new high-definition version of the film. So that, what, we can see more warts on the Wicked Witch? Robert Osborne is host of Turner Classic Movies. He's a film historian, and he filmed a special introduction for the screenings. Robert, what do you see that we haven't seen before?
It's a spectacular look that it has because of the color. Wizard of Oz has always been kind of like a comic book come to life with vivid reds and blues and emeralds and greens, and they just leap out even more than they have. But it's kind of a totally new experience to also see it on a big screen.
So what can you see? Because we hear there are some details, for instance, that even people who have memorized the film...
Well, you do see details. You even see the wires somewhat of the flying monkeys.
Take special care of those ruby sippers. I want those most of all. Now fly! Fly!
Well, it was always critically well-received. But you told the Associated Press recently that it could have been an entirely different film. How so?
Well, I think that's one of the wonders of it, too. Casting is so important, and this has, like, the perfect cast. We could have, by all intents and purposes, be seeing Dorothy, played by Shirley Temple. We could see The Wizard of Oz, played by W.C. Fields. We could have The Wicked Witch, played by Gail Sondergaard, who is a very tall, elegant, beautiful woman. And she would have been more like the witch in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Also, the original plan was to not have a man dress up as a lion. They thought that might be too hard for people to digest or accept. And they were thinking about having a real lion travel with Dorothy and Toto, but have a man dressed as the Tin Man and a man dressed as the Scarecrow. You know, there was also going to be a prince in it, a young prince and a princess and a love story thrown in. Well, what we got turned out to be just about as perfect as it could be.
And what about getting another one? There have been several spin-offs and sequels. There was Disney's Return to Oz, there's The Wiz, the Sci-Fi Channel's The Tin Man, and of course, Gregory Maguire's Wicked franchise, books, and a Broadway musical. And now there are rumors of a new, darker sequel to The Wizard of Oz with Dakota Fanning playing Dorothy's granddaughter. What do you think about that?
Well, it could be all of that, you know, but it's just trying to capitalize something that's almost perfect. And many sequels could come and go, many imitations can come and go, but with Wizard of Oz, they made it pretty perfect the first time, and we still have it with us, which is the great thing about our world today, that these movies don't go away like they used to go away. And so it's wonderful we have the original and can enjoy it. And there will probably never be a Dorothy that will touch people's hearts as much as Judy Garland did, or a lion that could make people laugh as much as Burt Lahr does.
Put 'em up! Put 'em up! Which one are you first? I'll fight you both together if you want. I'll fight you with one paw tied behind my back. I'll fight you standing on one foot. I'll fight you with my eyes closed.
Just the fact that it's being shown has gotten people in our office, for instance, talking about memories of, you know, being the Wicked Witch at Halloween or helping somebody make a Tin Man costume. What's your feeling about this film?
Well, I think that it's one of the amazing things of the film is the fact that a movie... It was made 70 years ago when the world was entirely different, and yet that movie has not changed. We still responded in the same way that people did back then. It's also wonderful that Wizard of Oz is staying in step with the times. We have high definition now that we didn't have before, and to be able to have a copy in Blu-ray of Wizard of Oz in high definition, I think, is a great thing, and it makes it forever new.
Robert Osborne, host of Turner Classic Movies and a film historian, speaking about tonight's screening of the new digitally enhanced version of The Wizard of Oz. We'll have more information at our website, hereandnow.org. Robert, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And by the way, that iconic song almost didn't make it to the film. The director thought it slowed the movie down, and it was only added at the last minute. Back in 30 seconds with the story of the MIT of the Arab world offering free tuition to all students here and now.
That you dare to dream really do.
Ceremonies are underway today in Saudi Arabia to unveil what's being billed the MIT of the Middle East. The King Abdullah University of Science and Technology will be the world's sixth largest university. They're calling it KAUST. It was built from scratch in just a few years in the sands along the Red Sea, north of the commercial center of Jeddah. It boasts high-tech bells and whistles, a $10 billion endowment, and the claim that it will be a secular haven in a decidedly non-secular country. But who is this elite school built for? Students in the Middle East and North African countries score far below the world average in math and science. Sandra Upson is a reporter with IEEE Spectrum magazine. She's on the campus there today. Sandra, put this in context, because we know this, the region has other schools of higher education, but this university was built so quickly. What's the rush and what's the goal?
To put it bluntly, King Abdullah is in his mid-80s and probably doesn't have a whole lot of time left and wants to leave behind a legacy in education, especially given some of the figures that you just cited on the underperformance of Saudi students compared even to students within their region. So this school is just a grad-level institution. It'll be accepting students for, you know, master's degrees and PhDs. So it's not really addressing the issue on the, you know, basic level of kindergarten through, you know, the first few grades. But it does hope that by attracting students, you know, internationally and by pulling in some students and keeping them local, they'll be able to spin off some companies and, you know, develop some innovative new technologies that can diversify their economy at home and try and create more jobs at home so that, you know, students with a wide array of interests don't all either end up working in the oil business or doing nothing at all.
Right. The country, you understand, wants to go beyond oil. And the school was designed with the help of universities from around the world, including one in Cambridge, England, and California. But the AP says KAUST has accepted more than 800 students from more than 60 different countries. Only 15% are Saudi. So at least in the short term, it's not going to be helping Saudis.
That's right. But also in the short term, I think they're trying to establish it as a place with fairly Western values where, you know, Western standards of education are being applied and students can begin to acclimate to a slightly different sort of educational climate.
Well, let's talk about some of the things you mentioned. The draw for professors, there are the bells and whistles. We will talk about that. But also part of that huge endowment was to attract some of the top scientists to the faculty. And the endowment's also going to defray costs for students. We understand it's about $70,000 a year per student, but every student's tuition is paid for?
Yeah, all of the tuition is covered, and then there's also a living stipend and a research stipend on top of that. So it should be a pretty seamless transition into, you know, arriving here and being able to do some research once they're on campus.
Wow, I mean, that's a huge that they'll be paying all the tuition, but also giving them more freedom than others might enjoy in mainstream Saudi society. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in mainstream Saudi society, especially women, you know, don't have the opportunity to drive. They, you know, have to study separately from men and, you know, have to cover themselves and dress in a certain way. So, but on this campus, they will be allowed to drive and, you know, dress as they wish and study alongside men. So it seems like it should be a more open environment and more conducive to just collaboration, you know, regardless of gender and regardless of background.
Well, people involved in the school say Saudi King Abdullah hopes that that culture is going to eventually spill outside the campus gates. But what's been the reaction to that, because we understand that hardline clerics are already attacking more liberal schools. In June, the religious police cracked down on a sort of a residential and resort community north of Jeddah. It's not far from Khoust, and men and women mixed there. Women had been seen driving. So won't this school become not just symbol, but potentially target?
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a tough battle. There is still a fairly much more conservative sort of middle layer of management, and especially in the Ministry of Education. So there is definitely some resistance there, but the hope is that, you know, this is going to be a gradual process.
Right.
Certainly the first generation of grad students is not going to spill out into mainstream society, changing the way that things are done here. But, you know, over the course of a decade, maybe two decades, you know, some companies may start working in the business and hiring these grad students, and maybe the culture will start to open slowly but surely. As the president of the university, who comes from Singapore, cited earlier today, you know, basically they've got a million-step journey, and they've just made the first few strides.
Well, inside the campus, as we said, are some of these state-of-the-art bells and whistles. What's there?
First of all, there's the fastest supercomputer in the Middle East called Shaheen, which means peregrine falcon, which is one of the fastest flying birds. And in addition to the supercomputer, they also have a nanofabrication facility that has one of the cleanest clean rooms in academia anywhere. They also have Cornea, which is this cave system, which is basically six walls, you know, the four regular walls plus ceiling and floor, where you can visualize data in 3D. You wear those, you know, 3D glasses. And they also have audio location so that the audio sounds like it's coming from very discrete points in that room. When we got to try it out yesterday, they had a demo of an archaeological dig in Jordan. So basically what it was, you know, you had the surface level of the ground and then a big hole. And inside the hole, they were able to locate where exactly those artifacts were found. Mm. So if you were an archaeologist, you could then go into this hole and kind of get a sense of the spatial organization and the spatial arrangement of these artifacts that you found, and maybe derive some additional information.
As you say, it's a cave system, which means it projects all the images you were just talking about on all four walls, on the ceiling and the floor. So you were literally inside it.
Yeah, we were literally inside it. They closed off the wall, and you wear these glasses, and the perspective changes as you move around. And it's absolutely really stunningly realistic. I mean, at one point, I was standing on the ground, what was supposed to be the artificial ground, and all of a sudden, I ended up peering over the hole, and I actually sort of stuttered and caught myself because I thought I was going to fall into the hole, which is totally ridiculous because I know perfectly well that I'm just in this box, but it was that convincing that I thought I was going to fall.
That's Sandra Ufsen, a reporter with IEEE Spectrum, the magazine for technology insiders. We speak to them quite a lot. And Sandra, you sound very excited, and as we said, you're right there at the opening of this new King Abdullah University of Science and Technology outside Jeddah. What's the feeling around you?
Ramadan just ended, and so basically everyone is in party mode. In a few minutes, I'm about to head over to a tent that was built just for this ceremony where the king will be inaugurating the campus. And just for that tent alone, apparently it was about a $60 million structure.
$60 million?
I mean, the numbers are staggering. Yeah. Everything's in the millions.
Thank you for being our eyes and ears and letting us in on it, Sandra. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
So, free tuition and a stipend for students, and healthy salaries and all expenses paid for faculty and their families. We'll have more information for you at our website, hereandnow.org. While there, remember, you can click on Contact Us, send an email, or just scroll down and leave a comment, hereandnow.org. That in a minute, how cameras unlock people frozen by disability, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back.
I run into situations where little kids, we're talking about 5, 6 years old, will walk up to me and say, "What's wrong with you?" That's why I love kids.
That's Tony Knight. He's confined to a wheelchair by cerebral palsy and joins several others in the same situation at the United Cerebral Palsy Day Experience Program in a nondescript building in Watertown, Massachusetts, that's magically transformed by the arrival of a photographer named Courtney Bent. She first saw Tony and his friends as subjects, but then made them photographers. Her documentary is called Shooting Beauty, Everyone Deserves a Shot. She made it with her husband, documentary filmmaker George Cacciadorian. And Courtney joins us with more. Courtney, we understand you first saw a severely handicapped person at an event. You were drawn to them and subsequently the Day Center. But you're a fashion photographer. Your mother was a model. You grew up with beauty. Many participants at the day school have been contorted by their illness. They can't speak. What was it like when you first began going there?
It was a little scary because I'd never been in this type of environment. I'd never worked with people with disabilities. And then the more I was there, they weren't self-conscious at all about having their pictures taken. I started to realize there was this vibrant, exciting, fun world within this facility that I was in.
And yet, when you showed the pictures that you were taking to other people, they said, oh, that looks so scary. That looks awful. The pictures weren't reflecting how you were feeling about the people.
No, no.
And so you decided, why don't they take their own pictures? Now, here we come to the part of the film, and let's listen to a little bit of what it's like to carry that out with people who often can't move their thumbs, can only use their tongues, perhaps, to work a camera. Let's listen.
Okay, first of all, you want to have this little bump on the bottom, okay?
The bump?
Yep. Can you see? How is your eyesight? Let's see, what, can you move this hand at all? Okay, which finger works? So, EJ, what do you think is going to be the best for this chair? Are we going to have to build something new, you think, or?
Maybe we can make another button.
Make another button. One that's easier to press.
Yeah.
Okay, so if this were here, it's the camera's not on, but try, let's see if you try pushing it, see if, ooh, with your chin. That might work.
Tell us about some of what are now your students, Courtney. For instance, about EJ, one of the most severely disabled of the people you're working with. How did he end up taking his photographs?
Well, he was in his chair, and his body, as you said, was very contorted. He had no use of his hands, and he had no use of his legs. So the one thing he was able to do was use his tongue. I found a camera and a cable release system that we had mounted right next to where the dowel was that he drove his wheelchair. So he would press the button with his tongue.
Describe some of the images.
Great. One of my favorite images taken by EJ was taken in his living room. At one point, I just set his camera up, and he spun around to face the wall. And he leaned in and took a couple pictures. And I looked at him. I said, EJ, you know, this is going on in my head thinking, oh, this is just a waste of film. This is exactly what I didn't want to have happen. He's just taking a picture of the wall. And I said, EJ, what are you doing? He said, I'm just taking a picture of the heart. And I looked over on the wall, and it was just this completely blank wall. But right in the middle was this beautiful little heart that he had made.
Another participant, Mary Jo Chasen, also confined to a wheelchair, very verbal, though. And this scene illustrates how each of the participants would help the other, try to make up for another's disability. Here she's trying to help you understand the thoughts of another man with a little less language skill. Let's listen.
Say it again, Steve. That's what he usually says.
He gives up so easily.
He gives up so easily, and he says, never mind. Say what you were going to say, Sue. You want... You want what? You want a camera. He wants a camera.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Was there anyone you couldn't work with photography with?
Yeah, that's a good question. Initially, actually, one of the people that was in the program who eventually started taking pictures, he had a hard time socializing.
Is this Tom?
This is Tom, yeah. So he, for a very long time, just avoided me. And I think that was a case of a few of the people in there because they hadn't been really socialized. They were used to either being with people who were from their community or people who had disabilities or being with their families who were comfortable with people with disabilities, but they had not integrated much into society.
Well, Tom in particular, let's explain. His friend, a social worker and a foster mother, explains that Tom lived with her and 44 infants and never came down from his bedroom from the time he was born till 18 years later because there was no wheelchair. And when one is built, we see it. He's sort of laying almost on his stomach with his legs behind him. His spine is so contorted. But he does eventually not just take pictures but videos. Let's listen to one that he took.
Hello.
This is Tom Herrick signing off for a while. I hope you enjoyed this, Courtney. Over and out.
What did you see photography do for Tom?
Basically, it brought him out of his shell, and it gave him a reason to get through his day. He was definitely depressed, and he had a really hard time finding sort of a purpose to get up out of bed each day. And this gave him not only, you know, something to do, but it gave him a purpose. He really became somebody behind that camera, and he really found his voice behind that camera.
What were some of the pictures, images Tom captured?
When I first gave him the camera, I said, just go photograph, you know, your world. I want to see what your world is like. You know, introduce me to your life. And he came back with a roll almost full completely of self-portraits. And to me, that was amazing coming from somebody who had been so closed off from everybody else to suddenly now turn the camera around and do something as brave as take a self-portrait, which can always be difficult to turn the camera on yourself. And now he was looking at, you know, these pictures were basically saying, hey, look at me. Here I am. So it was almost like he was reintroducing himself to the world through his photographs.
Well, without giving away the ending, it becomes very important that Tom have that thing that give his life purpose. And then something else happens for all the students in the film, which is that almost miraculously, when you think about it, they suddenly get a photography show and celebrity-dom. And how are they reacting now? Now it's a film. But they still are participants in the Cerebral Palsy Day experience.
Well, one example would be Mary Jo, and she, after seeing the film, said to her mom, hey, Mom, I just want to let you know, I promise I'll come home on Thanksgiving and Christmas, but just so you know, I'll be in Hollywood. So, I mean, they love it. I mean, they all just love it. It's just, it's one of those things where it doesn't have to, just having that one moment, just even having one moment where they're in a big theater and they get to see it on a big screen in front of a, you know, crowd of 400 people, that is just an amazing experience for anybody.
Tonight,
yes.
Your photographs are so beautiful.
Thank you so much. This is the greatest feeling I've ever had, and nothing can top this. Nothing can top this.
We did it. We did it.